Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I'm excited to be in the garden with Jimmy and Michaela Doherty. Jimmy, a well-known face on TV for numerous series, including Jimmy's Farm, Jamie and Jimmy's Friday Night Feast with childhood mucker Jamie Oliver, Food Unwrapped, and many more. Jimmy met Michaela when Jimmy was working as a pig farmer and Michaela was a runner for TV. Michaela carried on working in TV until she left to help Jimmy run the Pannington Hall Farm. Michaela is the keen gardener and has developed the gardens at Jimmy's Farm, as well as running the business side, organising the staff and injecting ideas and direction into it. A great team. Fabulous to be here. Thank you very much for doing this. I haven't been here for about 15, 16 years, and you had a big pop festival.
Yes, we've had a number of different festivals, and we've been here now for 21 years.
22 years.
I cannot believe the difference when I was last here. And then reading your Jimmy's Farm book, which explains your whole journey, I mean, it just seems extraordinary. Yeah, do you sit up and blink now when you look around you? And I'm standing in front of this amazing garden with box edging, shrub roses, tulips, a lovely big clip bay in the middle, beautiful farmyard. It looks Dalesford, I have to say. It wow. Really does. We're at Dalesford earlier. Well, it does.
It varies sometimes. Sometimes it feels like we've been here 5 minutes, other times it feels like we've been here 60 years, doesn't
it? I think definitely it's been absolutely challenging. And it's funny that you say, oh, we should, you know, we come in and we think that it's, you know, look how much we've achieved. But actually, most of the time when we come in, peacocks are going. Yes. Most of the time when we come in, we're constantly looking at the issues that are going on. So it's challenging.
You always see the work that needs to be done rather than the achievements, I think, sometimes. But I think the one thing that sticks in my mind in terms of time measurement is the trees that we planted. Mm. So most of the trees at the orchard here, a lot of the trees running down the back of the turkey tunnel, we all planted. And when you suddenly see an oak that you can't put your hands around, mm. you think, oh, I planted that as a little tiny whip. And all of a sudden you go, wow, we've been here a long time.
Yeah, and they change the microclimate so
completely.
Much, don't
this
they?
This is quite a windswept site. And, and where we're standing at the moment was the old dairy yard. So this originally was a cattle farm in terms of dairy production. And the Wilsons farmed it. And they came from Scotland and bought their cattle with them, and this was the dairy yard where all the cows were held before they went into the dairy parlour, which is now a shop. Yeah. And this was the calf pen, which is now our ice cream parlour. But so everything was pretty windswept and derelict and barren. So the first thing was to try and plant some trees and bring the land back into some sort of form of productivity.
That was a massive dream, though. When you first set eyes on it, do you both remember the day when you first saw it? And just describe what you saw when you arrived for the first time.
You go, cows.
Well, you'd seen it before me. He had rented it already before yeah. I had even been here. But when I remember coming down the drive and just thinking, oh, my God, the amount... I remember thinking, I think this is slightly mad. I think you're slightly crazy, because it was totally derelict. The whole site was totally derelict. Every single building that you see here, from the restaurant to the farm shop, everything had holes in the roof. It was falling down. Mm. So there's nothing. There was no water. There was no electricity. I mean, it was the most basic place. But there was it was so romantic.
There was a couple of rose bushes still standing, and there was a few bits and bobs. I remember coming down the lane, and I've been to various different farms to look at renting farms, and a lot of them were quite soulless, fairly modern buildings and conventional open land. This had 30 acres of wood. It was fairly undulating, which is quite nice in terms of being in East Anglia. Mm. And it had all these buildings. You walked up this little track, and you could almost feel how it would have been and how it operated. And it had a character. And I think, I always say, it's a bit like seeing, a sculptor seeing a lump of rock, and you could see the potential inside.
But yeah, it sang to me, thinking I could see where the shop would be, and this is where we could have the chickens, and this is where the pigs would be. I could see it all unfolding.
Mm. Really? In that first moment? Yeah. I think the arrangement of farm buildings often are in courtyards, aren't they? They were arranged like that, which is a lovely feeling. It gives you that sort of security with the wrap round by the buildings. And they do make fantastic places to convert, but they are hard work, aren't they?
Yeah, oh yeah, they're all hard work, and you're constantly finding stuff as well. So when the garden we're standing in now, this was the cattle yard, and it had real heavy chalk, which was put down and pounded as being a surface area for the cattle to then put deep litter on. And then we started digging around. We found all these old bricks, part of the building. So the first thing Michaela did was we dug all the bricks up, and we cleaned them off, and you started the garden here. You started this courtyard garden was the first thing you put in, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Did you based it on something that your mum or dad had done?
Well, marginally, only because my father was in the Gurkhas, and he had gardened all over the world, and he kept designing these gardens, so I was very much influenced by him.
That's so unusual, to be designing gardens.
Yeah, I mean, he designed, because we were in military quarters all the way across the world. You know, I was born in Hong Kong. We had a great sort of Asian influence within my upbringing. And actually, the way this garden was designed, I don't know if this was a subliminal thing, but actually, if you go to Kathmandu Airport, there is a little outdoor garden as you arrive, and it is in almost this kind of classical design of courtyard garden. So I don't know whether that was why I put it in.
So it made an impression on you, and you sort of recreate it subliminally, probably.
I think so. And it worked. And it worked in terms of the setting of the courtyard and the centre point of the bay tree.
And we kept that old ash tree, didn't we? Everyone said cut the ash tree down because it was in the way, and it was much smaller then, but we kept it.
No, I think that's key now.
Yeah.
For shade and, you know, for customers.
It's a very symmetrical design, isn't it? And the ash tree just throws it off, which makes it quirky and gives it more personality, doesn't it? And functionality as well.
Yeah.
And so your grandmother?
My grandmother. I mean, it fascinates me, but she went to RHS Wisley and she graduated, I think, one of the first women in 1922. So there is a great history within the family of gardening and loving being outside. I mean, she was academically trained. I mean, she's properly trained. And I think that obviously was inherited by my father and then on to me. But obviously, I am not academically trained in gardening. I just love it. And I think certainly when... The impression that I hope that people, when they come here to Jimmy's farm, is that it's just this feeling of quite a natural planting and gentle orchards, productivity, things that they can buy in the farm shop and restaurant.
And there's always space for nature. That's
space for nature.
You, when you arrive along the lanes, you come down the lanes and you see sight of the animals, the saddlebacks in the fields and things like that. So you have that great build-up as you come along the lanes. Then I hit the drive and the apple trees, I think, look lovely. They look so right there, don't they, as you come down that lovely long drive and then you come into the collection. It's a sort of succession of revealing things as you come, isn't there? Very big, busy car park, very full, very active. It's hugely successful. Isn't it?
Well, it is. But the thing with the apple trees is we planted this orchard here and they were all tiny little things.
But
you can see them all leaning where the wind's blown them. It's all hickledy-pickledy.
That's nice.
Well, it's like an old-fashioned orchard, isn't it? But the thing is, we encourage kids to pick the apples. And so we have so many apples. I mean, the animals can't eat enough apples. And we put the apples in the restaurant and all the rest of it. But to get the general public to come in and go, oh, it's all right to pick the apples. Of course you can. And even with the veg garden... If I see children picking the courgettes, I say, you pick a courgette. You've got to eat it, though. And then and they're like, oh, okay. And they eat the courgette, the raw courgettes. And I love that aspect of it, where I think so many places you go to, it's keep off the grass, or you can't do this, can't touch that. But if you're going to pick the herbs, take them home and use them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's
encourage them to get into it. And so the vegetables you grow for the restaurant or for show or because it's part of the thing.
A bit of a mix, to be honest. And I think the it was a very much of a working garden to start off with. Yeah. But I think as we've got busier and busier in the restaurant, we grow various stuff, mainly a lot of the herbs that we use. But it's more to get people engaged and have a look and touch and smell and all the rest of it. And we've got a massive wedding marquee. And what's lovely is that when the bride and groom come out, they walk through a vegetable garden. Mm. You know, and I love that being on farm, connecting to food all the time is really important.
And you got married, I read, in somewhere like Hello, Wow, on a pink tractor. And that was a tractor that Jimmy gave to you for a birthday present.
It was, yeah.
And you sprayed it pink?
Yeah, well, actually, Jim sprayed it pink.
Barbie pink.
Oh, gosh.
Now, but yeah. It was...
Everyone at the factory thought it was for Katie Price.
Yeah. Gosh, I'm just like,
But it was still got that tractor. But that took us from the church in the village down here, and the farm wasn't like it is now, but we had a marquee and we had a big hog roast and sitting on straw bales. It was great.
Yeah, and nothing, you know, as we walk around, you'll see that nothing is actually symmetrical in the whole place, because I remember planting this courtyard garden. I was trying to get it in line with the kind of the apex of the barn, and I was thinking that that's where you had to come down and then you're going to walk through the gardens all the way down to the bottom, but actually everything's slightly on the wonk. Everything just doesn't quite fit.
But anyway, it all looks balanced and interesting, doesn't it? It works really well.
Lovely.
But so I think being in telly and running this, there's quite a few similarities. I mean, it seems to me on telly everything's done on the hoof and things go wrong and everything, and this must be the same, that there must be things happening all the time that you have to get your head around and sort.
Yeah, everything, every day. We have plans. We have like a 5-year plan, 10-year plan, a 20-year plan, and all these, you know, plans that you have. Really important to give you direction.
Yeah.
But things turn on the sixpence, so all of a sudden you're like, right, that's changed. Or even government policy might change all of a sudden, or planning policy, or whatever it is.
Grants.
You know, with staff as well, you know, it's not just about animals, it's about people. So you constantly got to do various stuff. And I always think it's a bit like the guy that used to see on the London Palladium spinning plates on those long sticks. And then he's got to run over there and do another one. And that's about to fall. So it's a bit like that.
So how many are you employing now, talking of staff?
I season, it's 140.
Yeah, 140 staff.
And that ranges from the livestock guys and the farming side of things to the catering staff, to chefs, to wildlife rangers.
Retail.
There's
centre.
Yeah, there's all sorts.
But there's someone here, obviously, all the time to keep their eyes and ears open. If a pig is poorly
or if
something's wrong with the vegetable,
have our own vet. So our vet's here for... He works 2-3 days a week.
Yeah.
And we have our own little veterinary room. And so there's always someone for the animals. There's a whole livestock team.
And you need a full-time vet.
Part-time. Absolutely, because not only are we dealing with the farmed livestock, but we've got our wildlife park, so everything from camels to polar bears to crocodiles. So the expertise needed, and I thought farming there was a lot of red tape, but when you're dealing with wildlife and wildlife conservation, there's a whole area of your conservation policy, your education policy, the daily checks that you're doing. It's quite full on, that, isn't it?
It's full on, and then you've got the council.
And the public.
Yes.
Keeping the public happy is not always easy.
Well, it's not always easy, but that's the fun part,
that's
I think.
That's the best
because thing. That's, in so many ways, that's your reward. And I think, particularly with farming, no one ever goes, oh, well done, that's a great job. No one ever does that. And I visit farms and factories up and down the country and abroad for the last 20 years. And it can be a very lonely job. And farmers in the UK do an amazing job, but no one really goes, do you know what? That's brilliant what you've done. Your products are fantastic. Because they're off to the supermarket. They're sold as commodity. And what's lovely is when you get the general public going, oh, what you've done here is lovely. What you've done for that animal there is great. Or we've had the turkey. It's the best turkey we've ever had. All those kinds of things. It's lovely to hear.
Yeah, that recognition's really, has been quite important, I think, particularly in you know, really difficult, hard times. Mm.
But we're lucky to get that. Most farmers don't get that.
Yeah, indeed.
No, they don't. They just get, oh, we're not giving you that for your grainage share. The price is suddenly dumped because the suet is all something else.
Well, that's it
is really difficult. But if someone had come to you and waved a magic wand and say, I'll back you and put a few million in and create a park, you would have probably jumped at it. But actually, with hindsight, the way you've built it up organically with your backs to the wall, it must be much more satisfying like that, don't you think?
I think so. And I think, you know, we have had offers and things like that in the past, or people say we can, and it would be easy to go, great, amazing. But then I suppose you lose what it's about and lose control. And also, I think now that we've got kids, that I think with four daughters at different ages, they've got different interests, and one's slightly interested in the food side of things, the other one's a bit more the farming, and one of them's interested in the exotics, one's just obsessed with lambs. But
is that the youngest?
Or anything fluffy. But I think the idea of that, what would their position be in the business, you know, how would they might like to take it on, you know, so it's
It seems weird when you look back at what you've done, and it says you were tossing up between the Royal Marines and zoology.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a contrast there.
There is. Well, I, as a kid, I was obsessed by the military. And when I was
and Gerald Dowell. It seems like you were a mini Essex version of Gerald Dowell.
I used to run home from school. I had all these books, but I used to run home from school because he had a TV show that started at 3:50 or 3:30, and I just got off the bus in time and run home and watch Gerald Dowell's Complete Amateur Naturalist, which he made a little series about. So I was obsessed with wildlife and nature, but at the same time I was really into the military, and when I was doing my A-levels, I joined the Territorial Army and I was in the Royal Signals for 5 years, but I loved the Royal Marines, and I wanted to be an officer in the Royal Marines, and I had all the pamphlets and I used to just constantly read them. But I think I remember writing this list, the zoology one side, military the other, and there was just a few more things on the animal side that interest me, and that led me into going off and doing zoology and whatnot. But yeah, we still do a lot with the military, but I think I don't know what it is, because one side you've got nature is all chaotic and then you've got organization, military on the other, and that's a bit like our life. I think we like to have, I'm obsessed with straight lines and rules and regulations. I'm a bit OCD, line all my books up. At the same time, I like a bit of chaos as well.
That's a weird combination.
Completely weird.
Do you not?
So I annoy me.
Yeah.
I annoy myself.
I have to keep him in check.
What, the OCD side or the wild side?
It's interesting. It's interesting. It's actually been really helpful in terms of everything, actually, from designing even the farm shop here. He's creative at heart, but likes things just so. And actually, that's worked incredibly well here.
Yeah.
Well,
I can tell when someone's come in and moved. I can tell when someone's moved things straight away. I'm like, that book's slightly out. Who's someone's? You know. And the worst thing my friends do if they come over, they will go, well, my book collection, I'll take a book out and turn it upside down, or they'll put one book in the wrong area
to wind you up.
Yeah, or over COVID, I bought loads of toy tanks that I had as a kid, and I found them on eBay. I said, and I got about 8 of these tanks. I lined them all up, and my friends come around like for dinner, or whatever, and they'd move the turrets in different directions and not tell me, and then send me a text, and I had to go straight up and sort them out. But
he's like Annie from Misery.
Yeah, that's right.
Who's I don't know what he's going to turn into, to be honest.
But the whole overall feel, like inside the restaurant with the old carpets on the floor and the lovely rustic table, who does the overall design feel?
You do.
That's you, Miguel. Yeah, so you're the design.
Yeah. I love that, and I love the exploration of elsewhere as well. So you're constantly nicking ideas. We'll go to, I don't know, Beth Chateau's or Peterton or Dalesford or, you know, all these lovely places.
Yeah.
And then you steal what you like.
Well, that's the great thing about smartphone, just take pictures of everything.
Yeah. Pinterest, I mean, yeah. I mean, the creative side on that is really, really...
Yeah.
It's come together really well. So where can we see your pigs? You started off with pigs,
yes,
didn't you?
Yeah.
Can we go and see your pigs?
The herb garden.
Oh yeah, that'd be lovely. Yeah. So you've got lots of box here. Hedging. How do you deal with your box moth? Oh, there's your box moth from last year.
So we will spray this fairly shortly.
Yeah, with the bacteria. Yes. Yeah, bacillus. Yes. Yeah.
So we will probably, everything needs to be cut and trimmed at the moment, and then we'll spray.
Bit early to cut those because we're still getting frost. So when will you cut yours?
Well, I'll wait for a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
And then we will spray. But I think. I don't know. It's all looking quite fresh at the moment.
It's lovely. Yeah, I love this greenness sort of
when the box comes through.
Yeah,
so fluffy, it's always quite attractive. Growth. But then it looks a little bit messy, and I do like it. As does Jim, looking a little bit smarter.
Spreads so quickly.
It does.
We're very keen on nature, and we breed a lot of butterflies and moths in the butterfly house. But you suddenly realise how quickly they can just spread. It's unbelievable. And in fact, when I take you to the butterfly house, you'll see plants like that. But it's
for their feed.
Feed for the butterflies. But in the garden, that's a problem. We try really not to spray any chemicals at all. We're not organic certified, but we are pretty much organic anyway. But so anything we try to do will be natural pest control, really, and biological control.
But that bacillus is natural, isn't it?
Bacillus thuringiensis.
It is a natural one that you can use, so that is quite okay. But I'm just replacing now. Box with you, I'm finding, in these sort of situations, because you can keep you dwarf as a dwarf hedge. It's not that lovely spring green, but it doesn't get the blight or the moth. But
so that's good management.
It's always hard to plug a gap as well, isn't it? Because as soon as you have a gap, we'll get kids zoom through, and then you never really get to plug it.
Sometimes you can just put little hoops of hazel or willow, little ones in the ground to reinforce it in places, and it gives them, and it looks nice. In the bed, seriously.
You wait till the kids are around.
Really?
They run along all the bricks. Yeah. They run, it's quite.
That's what we've tried to create. I suppose even the restaurant is all about chunky furniture. If your kids annoy, it doesn't really matter. You bring
it's accessible.
Dogs in the woodlands, you can build dens and stuff, and the kids can run around on the grass and do all that kind of stuff. So it's very much about getting involved. So when kids do run across the bed, it's not don't be destructive, but actually if you're going to find some stuff out, and I'm very much in for that.
And also things like you've got there, like the catmint, the hebe, the phlox. They'll come back, won't they? It's not like they're going to be flattened.
They can take the punishment. They can,
They'll cope with all that. And it's lovely the way you've got this yard outside your restaurant, and then you've got steps going down to your wedding marquee. Is that it? That's phenomenal, that structure.
And these were the bricks that we dug up and rebuilt the wall. My brother built the wall.
So your brother's a builder?
Yeah, yeah.
That so must be mega useful.
It is, yeah. He works here now as well, so it's very, very useful.
And your dad works here too, or
no,
what?
My dad passed away, unfortunately, about 6 years ago. But he was a bricklayer, and it's a very useful skill to have.
Yes. Can you do it? Have you tried your hand at it?
But it's
quite
difficult.
Good.
Is
it's
it?
Quite good.
Yeah, I like the straight lines.
I'm quite good at pointing.
Yes.
Built this wall, I was pointing.
As long as it's warm. Yeah. Otherwise, it's murder. And this is your veg garden, which looks really apple pie, doesn't it?
Well, at the moment, it does.
We had more beds than this, didn't we? We did.
We had, in fact, I put in, there were 8 beds like this.
Yeah.
And it was too much work. It just was too much work. So we cut it back and tried to organise things. And actually, certainly in terms of an educational purpose, we've done these lovely neat rows in the first bed so that children can come along and they can learn about all the herbs. And then we have 2 big old veg beds at the back.
So school trips here, and it's quite a nice platform for them when the schools arrive. If the teachers are teaching about farming, for instance, they go from the pigs, the veggies, the restaurant, and we try and teach them about the whole cycle of food, and we have the beehives there and stuff like that. So it's quite a nice area for the school groups to congregate. But it's more of a show garden, this, now, than anything else, isn't it?
But I like the way you've done your herbs in rows. You've got a whole row of lavender, a whole row of other things like the that cotton lavender.
Yeah.
And it does make it easier to manage.
Yeah.
And I think they look lovely when you grow plants in rows like that, don't they? It doesn't look like a botanic garden somehow. I don't know why not, but it because you've arranged them perhaps more artistically than by genus. But it gives it order, and it looks beautiful. I think it's like a pattern work.
It's sensory as well. So for children, particularly, like the chives and the garlic chives, you crush them, you smell them immediately.
Yeah.
And all those things are really important. Like, herbs are really good for that for kids. Like rosemary, give it a squeeze, have a smell. And I think
for younger children in particular, that's really important.
Mm. There is a bit of a cheat though on this garden at the top with the herbs, because we put a membrane down because it was just so much work to keep weeding through, and actually because these are all perennials, everything stays pretty much the same. We're just replacing some at the moment, but yeah. We covered the top with bark and planted through the membrane, and it has just worked really, really well, and it keeps it nicely in order.
That's what I did in the East End of London. I was working on a council estate, and we did that system with shrubs, and it was maintained twice a year.
Yeah.
And it is brilliant. Yeah, it really does. And if you put enough bark on, you don't see the membrane at all, do you? You have to keep adding the bark or whatever, but it makes it very easy if you've got a weedy site, doesn't it?
Where we're standing now, this is at the bottom of the cattle yard, so this is where all the slurry and would come out here.
And when so it's we quite arrived, fertile.
But when we arrived, it was brambles and nettles, and you couldn't wade through it. It was unbelievable. And so this was one of the very first paddocks we tried to get back to grass. And when I started, all I had was a strimmer, really. But I did have some geese, and I started with the pigs in here. And the pigs turned it over, and the geese were having a go at anything that was green. And then I brought in some Soey sheep that would nibble and eat everything, and some goats. And
all successionally, never together.
Well,
the
goats, the goats and the Soeys did quite a good job together. Mm. But there was a succession to the livestock, and eventually we could then put it down to grass, and then we grazed this whole area before we then put the beds in. But
it was, I see, it was so you did it with grass.
But it was good fun to use the livestock and watch what they did and learn by that.
Yeah,
because with pigs here for too long, they've just created massive craters. It would dig so deep, because there was so much wild forage for them to get. But then, just watching the Soey sheep and the goats work together, but the Soey sheep and the goats were a bit of a nightmare, because the goats would lead the sheep off. They would get out.
Really?
And they would together. They so would the Soey sheep and the goats. Would the goats have no respect for authority whatsoever?
No, goats are a pain.
Yeah, and they would be off. They would be off with them, but. It was interesting to see. So we still use that with the livestock.
The Soey sheep, I love. We have Soey sheep. We've had them for years. And I like them. You don't have to shear them. They never get stuck on their backs like real sheep. And they're totally self-sufficient. And I reckon I could leave the gates open and they would... they're so grounded, or hefted, you call it, don't you? And they just would never go.
You see, I've got a different opinion. We don't have Soeys anymore, but...
Why did you get rid of Soeys?
Because...
They're
wonderful. They were wonderful. And we've had various different breeds of sheep. And I was president of the Rare Breed Survival Trust for 6 years. And there's so many amazing breeds of sheep. And for us, Soeys did a great job. And then we moved on.
And so what do you think is superior to the Soey that I could get? That self-shearing, because I don't want to shear.
I don't want to upset any Soey people, because they're a great sheep. And they're also fantastic at crossing as well. We put South Downs on them, and they were really good.
And then you'd get a sheep that sheared itself.
Not
self-shedding.
Well, we get a better carcass confirmation for the restaurant. That was better for us.
Yes,
and then you get a really frugal mother who's really protective and low maintenance. But there's so many wonderful sheep out there. It's great. But you love sheep, don't you? That's a big thing for you. I prefer the pigs and the cattle.
I love sheep. As does our eldest daughter. Sort of kissable lips.
I like their eyes, their amber eyes of the Soey sheep. I think are gorgeous.
When you get a tame sheep, it's just the absolute best.
So, your pigs, where are your pigs?
The top here.
Oh, they're lovely, yeah.
And see how we've left all the elderberries that come here? Because I always think pigs are great at producing thistles. And elderberry trees, because they clear everything else on the land stuff, and then you've got all these pioneer plants that come in. But then I think the elderberries are great cover for the pigs, and also the thistles.
So they don't dig them up, the elderberries?
No, they've just left them. There's great cover for the pigs in the sun.
When the sun,
because they're low growing. And also with the thistles that we have so many goldfinches, charms of goldfinches everywhere.
Creeping thistles or the other thistles?
I don't know. I don't know what they would be. The other thistles.
Yeah, I hate the creeping thistles that are perennial and they have the really long, deep roots.
We probably have both. But then both are great for goldfinches and bumblebees.
I'm sure you're right.
We don't really mind thistles too much. I'm not sure about the arable farmers next door, though.
They love you. I bet they love you. But with pigs, you know, they always talk about this Iberian ham where they're finished on acorns.
Yeah, the papanegra and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the panniche and stuff. But I do wonder, because acorns only come out, well, will only be there for a season of the year. Presumably the pigs taste like they do mainly because they've been foraging from the worms and the beetles in the woodland.
Well, there's two aspects to that. I think when you look at the Iberico ham and the Patanegra, there's...
What are the Patanegra? What are they fed on?
The acorns.
There's
A grade and B grade, and one is fed on the fresh acorns and one's fed on stored acorns. So they get it the whole year round.
I see.
That definitely adds a flavour, but the flavour is in the fat, and the maturation is really important. So something like the black-footed pig, the Patanegra, they would mature those animals up to 18 months. Our pigs here would be 6 months. So the true development of flavour takes a long time, and the fat conformation is really important. And the omega-3s and the omega-6s, as the pig gets older, really balance out. And things like cholesterol, for example, if you look at olive oil and pig fat from a pig that's 18 months old, it's the cholesterol is the same as olive oil. So it's incredibly good for you. I think for when you're looking at pigs commercially, you give them a commercial feed and that would be fairly standardized, and it's wheat and barley and you've got soy protein in there, and it's all about being efficient and growth. But I think in terms of what the pig can get out in the environment, that definitely adds some flavour to it. Yeah, completely.
Yeah, because I try and do, we have two pigs in about half an acre of woodland, and the guy who does the home slaughter for us says that you could actually just give them no concentrate at all. They could get enough food from that. And I just give them a wee amount each day just to keep them very easy to tame. But I still find it really difficult to send them off when we dispatch them so that you can cook them with the crackling on them, you know, that you don't have 3 feet of fat before the bacon rind, because I love bacon rind, and that's always that thing in not letting them get too fat, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and that's the important thing. It's all about the protein in the diet. You want the growth. If it's loads and loads of carbohydrate all the time, carbohydrates, you know, essentially sugars, all the energies, that'll make you fat.
But where are they getting that from? The worms in the soil, the dandelion roots, the cow parsley roots?
All that kind of stuff is great if you've got it there for the pigs.
Yeah.
What you want for standardised growth is a formulated feed, and that really helps. If you're just doing it on nature itself, your pigs are going to take longer to grow.
I don't mind that.
Well, that's fine.
How long they take. We finish them on the apples and the quince.
Yeah.
Usually we try and do that so that we sort them just after we finish the last of those. And I have to say, they do taste delicious, but we do have a lot of fat bacon rinds.
But the thing is that with the fat, though, you could take that fat off and you can render it down and you can store it, or you could cure that
as
fat.
As dripping, as dripping, yeah.
Completely,
yeah.
And you have no need for buying in your vegetable fats to cook in.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you could big chunks of fat, you could cure that, like lardo, which is super delicious, and slice it very, very thin.
Oh, right,
There's endless things you can do with fat, and we all see it as a big problem. Fat doesn't make you fat.
No, I love fat. Yeah, it tastes so good, doesn't it?
But what you'll find, though, if you've got large layers of fat, so when you get the eye, the meat, the eye is often compressed and squeezed down. So if you're making your bacon, that eye would be squeezed
quite small
down.
Yes.
But if you know, there's two layers of fat for the pigs. There's the genetic fat and there's the fat that they put on. And so you want a nice even balance. I don't like really lean pork. It doesn't cook very well.
No.
But equally, you don't want copious amounts of fat.
Mm. Right, okay. So I've got to balance their food better.
Yeah, really. You know, but if you're doing it totally naturally, it's quite an experiment. It's quite nice to do.
And every batch is different. Every breed is different that we do. And it's extraordinary. It's a big learning curve, isn't it? I do remember seeing a load of research they did at Bristol University, and they fed cows on fish meal, all different types of meal, and they tasted the meat of the different...
Yep.
And it's amazing how the flavour of the meat and the contents of the fat from all the different types of foods.
Yeah.
And that was, I think that was intensively reared cattle. And it has a huge factor on the flavour.
Completely.
Yeah. But your cattle, are they all grass-fed? What have you got?
The cattle in here at the moment, they're waiting to go out. They'll be out tomorrow. And we've got a mixture of different breeds. You see the shaggy-looking ones there with a big white stripe down the back? They're Rigget Galloways, and the Galloways are a beautiful breed, and this is an interesting variant of the Galloway. everyone knows about belted Galloways and black Galloways, but the Rigget is a very ancient breed. And they always say any cow with a white stripe down the spine or goes back to Viking times.
Oh, really?
But these are really hardy, very rare, the Rigget Galloways.
Yeah.
Really hardy, do really well on grass. And then we have...
What about their personalities? And we have Dexters. Would they be as feisty as a Dexter?
Our Dexters aren't that feisty, to be honest. And we put a low-line Angus on the Dexters. So the low-line Angus is almost like a miniature Angus.
Yeah.
So the calves are really beefy. But we have Dexters, we've got the Rigget Galloways, and we have British Whites as well, which is a fantastic
Parkland
breed. Oh yeah, they just look so pretty. And then we've got Highlands as well.
We saw those on the way in, I think, down the road, the Highlands. Yeah, yeah.
They're always a favourite for the public, particularly the calves. They just look like teddy bears.
Yes.
But, you know, everything goes back into what we do. So education-wise or like for the restaurant, we do a beef night. And it's all a celebration of beef and different British beef breeds. And we have a whole side of beef hanging up and we butcher the whole thing and people have seven courses. And it's a real celebration of what this country does best, which is farming, but particularly beef, because beef gets a lot of bad press at the moment. It's destroying the world, which I think is an absolute myth.
Carbon emissions and all
You know, you can't just take beef production overall. And one thing this country does is grow great grass.
Yeah.
Because we have the rain for it.
Yeah.
And cattle are the best converters of grass into really wonderful high protein. So we've got some Oxford Sandy and Blacks.
Now they are my favourite breed of pigs. I love those. But it's because their character, the meat flavour, I think is fine, aren't they? And they are beauties, aren't they? With the gingery backs and the big
nice
black spots. Yeah.
They're nice to look at. And I always think if you're working with animals day in, day out, you should work with something that you really you like the look of.
Oh yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And, you know, when you see them in the sunlight and their backs are glistening of gold, you know, they're all waiting for their breakfast.
They are like big teddy bears, aren't they?
So we've got Oxford Sandy and Blacks there. There's a Gloucestershire Old Spot in there with them at the moment.
The little pinky white one. Yep. Yeah, sweet.
And
much smaller.
And over here we
And you breed these, do you?
Yeah.
I always buy them in as wieners.
No,
yeah.
we breed pedigree pigs, but everything goes into the restaurant. So we've got middle whites here, which is a beautiful pig.
Mm.
There was a small white, a middle white, and a large white. So the small white is extinct. So the large white went on to be the cornerstone of commercial pig production. It's still an absolutely fantastic breed. But middle whites are wonderful. They're really good pork pig. Have this lovely turned up snout and pricked ears.
Pretty they are.
And you've got pricked-eared pigs and you've got lopped-eared pigs. Come on, guys. I always find that the pricked-eared pigs are always harder to get on a trailer.
Because they can see where they're
they
going.
They can see where they're going. They're the first to come off the trailer as well.
Yeah.
But the large blacks here, it's a lovely pig. Very long pig, really good for bacon production. Wonderful fats, but they have these beautiful lopped ears.
Yeah.
Ginormous ears.
They can never see anything.
I see them as sunglasses. Because these are outdoor free range and Suffolk is blessed with lots of sunshine, they've got their own built-in sunglasses. So they're great pigs for this environment.
What we do with getting them on the trailer is a tip I learnt from the Archers, which was we put the trailer in the pig pen and I feed them in the trailer a couple of feeds before. And then you go in to take them off, poor things, to be dispatched, and they're in there snoring away. And I have to say, I love the Archers. And that, because it was so stressful trying to get a big pig up on a trailer.
Yeah.
And it, usually it's at 4 a.m. because you've got to get them to wherever by 6 or something. Mm. And it is the most stressful day. But now, thanks to Tom Archer,
that's perfect.
It's an absolute breeze.
We tried that once, and you leave a trailer in there, and they come in and they pull all the lights off the trailer and destroy your trailer. So what we try to do, we build a pen around their ark, and they go in there and they get used to the pen, and we just close the gate of the pen and then reverse the trailer, and then you can easily push them up onto the trailer. But we do find if you're moving,
push them up on the trailer. I don't believe that.
We don't have a problem with it. But what you will find if you've got a much larger pig, say we're moving a sow in with the boars and load up some of the sows, and if one doesn't want to go, what they'll do is they'll walk up and put some feed on the ramp, and they'll walk up the ramp eating, but the back legs remain
on
the ground.
Yes.
And any, if you make any move, they're straight off again.
Back. And we have to have these big boards, and it's awful. They're beautiful pigs. They all look, what is nice is they're nice, sparse populations, aren't they? I think that everything is not stressed. And I mean, they're having a play, but so often you see hundreds per square metre, don't you, or whatever. Well, and like, you just think it's stressful life for them.
Yeah, we don't overload the ground. You can still see the grass is coming through here. They've had a good old route around, and there's a nice even muck spread here, so we can then just come over and then cultivate, and we might top up a grass seed or some wildflower seeds or whatever else, and then rest it again. But this is very low intensity, and I've got to say that you know, this is one way of producing pork, but it is for a very specific market, and it's a very expensive way of doing pork. You know, if you think about free range pig production in the UK, true free range only represents 1% of the production systems, and so if we want to eat pork like this, it's going to be double the price.
I mean, round us are some really intensive pig farmers, and one went down about 10 years ago for 8 million, because there's just a slight increment in the increase in pig food, and his overheads completely change. And he goes out of business. And he'd been at it for years.
That's happened a number of times. It's very cyclic. And I think that's where we really need to be aware of the difficulties of farming, and you know, what we don't do is lose our farming industry. And we've seen the importance of domestic production is so important.
But standing here, I mean, Michaela, it looks like a really dreamy Constable painting in a way. I mean, I think of Essex and Constable, but we've got little thickets of trees and hedges and some little nettly bits, but it doesn't look unkempt. It just looks very natural. Essex, countryside, quite rolling, isn't it? Nice dips and hollows and humps. It really does look beautiful. And although you would look it to me, it looks very natural. You've obviously put a lot of thought into where you've put your hedges, and you've let the bits grow wild, and where you've cut and where you haven't cut, haven't you? So it does look it looks like a dreamy Seth Starkadder, how I imagine that would have looked back in, you know, Cold Comfort
Farm. I mean, it's
farm.
Lost in time. There is an element of it feeling like it's lost in time.
Yeah.
But actually, it is, I mean, it's managed,
certainly. Yeah. To get this look, it is, isn't it? But it looks
but
naturally
managed.
But it's
also not being afraid of it looking wild. So you've got these nettles and all sorts of wild areas. But actually, there is this, you know, this has not changed for the last 20 years that we've been here, in terms of we've put in hedgerows, we've done some planting, we've done some landscaping around the site, but actually, essentially, this is pretty much where we started. This is the way it looked, and I hope we never lose touch with that. That's really important.
I think there's another side to it. I think we're so obsessed with managing things, over managing things. So if you look beyond there, you can see very large arable fields. And still lots of the hedgerows are in, which is great, but I think we overmanage things sometimes. And there's definitely a mentality where farms have got to look hoovered.
Yeah.
Clipped this, clipped that. And you see the thickets over there with lots of nettles growing and the thistles over this side. That's all habitat for us. And we're really understanding now the benefit of biodiversity in terms of productivity. Because when you have really high biodiversity, you've got stability in the environment, and the more stable it is, the more productive it is. So putting all these hedgerows in here, making fields smaller, that's all going to be habitat for birds. And even when we have weddings, so there's that mature hedge line there, that was a wedding, that was an event, so they want to plant a hedgerow. And people want to plant trees, and trees are great in the right place. But I think that element of legacy, so for their wedding, there's a lovely hedgerow there, but that's going to be great habitat. That's wind production, wind protection for the garden. And it's putting all these little mosaic habitats back, which is really important.
Yeah, no, I think it looks really, really dreamy. And this is, you know, a cold mid-April day, isn't it? And it looks lovely. But throughout the year, it must look stunning in the winter, I think, even when it's bleak, because you've got these woods all around you, and the livestock, and it the whole structure looks great, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you get that lovely low light in the wood, on the woodland from up here. The sun sets just over the pigs here, and as you look across from the wedding venue, and it is idyllic, and it's without sort of sounding too cheesy.
You get big skies, don't you?
I mean, this is Suffolk. You get the big skies, even though it's probably the very few hills in Suffolk that we've got here. That's about the extent of it. But it is an idyllic place.
And what are your plans? What's your next step? I mean, it looks to me like it's done, but I can't believe you were ever going to stop.
This is such an interesting question, because I think we are... he's laughing at me because he keeps calling me up saying, yeah, no, there's these gorillas that need saving and we've got to go. And I'm just like, oh, my God, I just don't think
we... A gorilla garden for me to do.
Oh, my God. No, I will certainly, in terms of the gardening side and the landscaping, the site will continue to develop, principally because now our eyes are on the wildlife park and creating habitats for the exotic animals that we are taking on and rescuing. So, I mean, you'll go down to the polar bear enclosure in a minute. You'll see that it's looking a bit sparse because it's only just been landscaped, but that will be fully planted with all sorts of wonderful things that we actually have to teach ourselves about, to see what the polar bears are going to... I don't know what they're going to destroy and what they're not at this stage. I don't know. Yeah. But it's
not many people do know.
No, and that's it. We've obviously consulted a few experts, but God, even the council were wondering, sort of polar bears in a woodland. It's like, you know, what's the damage? And everyone was sort of like, well, we kind of don't know. They've done it sort of in Sweden. But actually, we're just going to have to wait and see.
It's interesting. So whenever, something like the polar bears or the wolves, is that you build this great big enclosure. It's Europe's largest polar bear reserve, and it's like, well, it's not just about the bears, it's what habitat you create for other wildlife. So we built this great big ponds, these lakes, 160...
How big is this biggest enclosure in the world?
So how many acres is this? The woodland alone is 6 acres, and there's 3 other big paddocks for them, and the one lake in there, one pond in there, is 16 metres deep. So it can dive all the way down and keep cool.
And you've built that?
Yeah, we've built all that. But that is going to be a wonderful wetland habitat. Mm. So it's not just about the polar bears swimming around. It's about the fish species, the dragonflies, the whirligig beetles, the wildflowers that we plant, all these sorts of things. So it's always more than just that individual. It's more than some of the parts, isn't it?
I know you've got to rush off, Michaela, and thank you very much indeed for coming. But I bought you both a present. I always do. So I bring a small present for my guests. And I bought you this huge thermometer. It's almost as big, I think, as a tapir's willy.
Wow. Jimmy, you know what?
You described a tapir's willy in your book, Jimmy's
yes,
Farm.
Yes, it's a sight to behold. It's what, it would be a very good a daffodil bulb planter.
That's incredibly kind.
But it's a lovely big thermometer, a metre or so long, that you can put. And I just find it really useful in the garden because you really brings home to what the temperature is.
Yes.
And when you're sowing seeds and growing stuff, it's lovely to know what your maximums are, what your minimums, and when you can sow and everything. But it's from the worm that turns.
Thank you very much.
And I hope
indeed.
You enjoy
That's
it.
That's really kind. I will
Thank
look
you.
At that fondly and remember the tapir's Venus. Glorious. Thank you so much.
Thank you both very much. That's Thanks. Grand.